This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. You too can get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox every weekday at bestevidence.fyi. And now, on with our episode.
Pam Vitale and Dan Horowitz were building a beautiful home and a beautiful life together. They had no idea they were sharing their mountain with evil.
I'm sharing my mountain today with Lonnie Diane Rich, who's back on the podcast to discuss two rushes to judgment by two prosecutors who never let evidence get in the way of a good railroading in a double Most Wanted episode. Injustice with Nancy Grace, Who Killed Garrett Phillips, and two very different sources of very similar rising fury in The Blotter Presents, episode 104. And it would be super nice if the end cue would... There we go. That's what post-production is for, ladies and germs. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast devoted to the idea that while crime is bad, stories about crime can be pretty good. Not always, but before we get into our crapperish first topic, let me introduce my returning guest from Chipperish Media, Lonnie Diane Rich. Hello again.
Hey, Sarah. It is so great. I always have such a great time hanging out with you, talking about anything. And I think that these episodes that we've chosen to talk about today are going to be really, really fun.
I think so, too. And I really am appreciating your positive attitude, given what we're talking about. First up, let's get this over with. Most Wanted section number one. Injustice with Nancy Grace, which premiered on Oxygen this past Saturday. Here is the case file, although if you know the name Nancy Grace, you probably don't need it, but this is from Oxygen's landing page, quote, exposing untold and riveting cases involving wrongful accusations, botched investigations, suppressed evidence, unclear motives, unjust sentences, and the path forward in seeking justice. That is not an entire sentence. Talk about unjust sentences. Also, she's kind of an expert at perpetrating a lot of these things. Yeah. We'll get into it. Like it or not, I'm going to go with not. Nancy Grace is a household name. And while the former prosecutor turned self-styled victims' rights advocate, snort, has historically shown little interest in the presumption of innocence, she's apparently willing to agitate for it when it comes to friends of hers who are not of color. Oxygen is also apparently willing to draft off Grace's star power, the better to eat A&E's pro-law enforcement programming lunch. I'm not sure where to begin this discussion, so I will assert in a general enjoyability of the show, minus the host, sense that this is just very standard by numbers garbage.
Oh yeah.
Would you agree?
Oh yeah. Flat garbage. Absolutely. It's presented. I when I think of Nancy Grace, like the whole thing, and I have
which
this,
you try not to do.
I try not to
I'm
do.
I'm sure.
Whenever I interact with her, like I'm an empath, so I pick up the energy of like the people that I'm watching or the people that I'm around. And I get really, really like on edge whenever I'm dealing with Nancy Grace because she is like an all caps person. You know, there's nothing about her that has nuance, that has consideration, that is going to wait for a moment to consider and weigh everything. It is pure evil. Like everybody is either pure evil or absolute saint. And there's nothing in between. And she gets exhausted after like 45 minutes of this. And at the end of it, I was like, I need a nap. You know, I don't know how people watch her show all the time.
I think that what you just said is probably the attraction.
Yeah, right.
I don't get it, but I can see that that kind of black and white approach and also the loyalty to cliche. Banalities is comforting for the kind of person who watches true crime almost exclusively to feel like this knowledge is power, control over situations that can't really be controlled. Mm-hmm. That's one of my grand unifying theories about why people consume true crime.
Yes.
I only have an AP in English. What do I know? I physically, aurally don't quite understand how people can tolerate her. I can do about this much because it's for work. My husband can't even, he can get like 4 words in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like too unpleasant for him to continue.
Yeah.
And that's just hearing it, never mind the content. But in the first clip in the main show, I pulled this because I almost admire, almost, the like relentless commitment to packaging these statements in the most cliched, just acidic way possible, and yet still kind of sounding like she believes them. There is a sincerity to it that is gross. Mm-hmm. Here is clip two.
We all know the statistics. When a woman is murdered, the first place you go is the husband. Of course. Familiarity breeds contempt. Contempt turns into hate. Hate turns into murder.
And then someone who either really believes in Nancy Grace or really is our people, mm-hmm, inserts this siren sound effect from the big CD of cliched true crime programming, Sound Drops Volume 4. We only saw the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
This concerns her friend, Dan Horowitz, as we heard at the top, whose wife was murdered, as it turns out, by their, like, Satan adjacent goth neighbor,
yeah,
teen, mm-hmm, kid, which is like, oh, the one time that the accused Satanists actually did it. Amazing. Actually, how did she find
even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? I mean,
eventually,
the little spin the bottle has to land on the goth kid. But the thing that was funny about this is that after like watching all that, and by the way, the familiarity breeds contempt, breeds hate, breeds murder. Like, is Nancy Grace married? Because I don't know.
She is.
It would seem to me that she would be worried that, that familiarity is going to breed that kind of contempt. Although, I don't know, she's busy, so maybe she's not around that much, her husband. But seems kind of an indictment of just a marriage in general.
My esteemed colleague and work wife, Tara Ariano, mm-hmm, and I used to joke about Sheriff John Bunnell, who used to narrate World's Wildest Police videos, mm-hmm, and how he was like completely over the top, like stalking around in his stand-up collar jacket and being like, this criminal learned the hard way. And then like some cliche about like if they had crashed into a tree,
mm-hmm,
it was like, you know, you're going to leave the scene in handcuffs. And we just wondered if like he was like that at home. But he's just standing in the kitchen, yeah, like getting a snack. And he's like, this jar of pickles learned the hard way. I'm going to spear your case or whatever. And his wife's like, Jesus, every time with this.
I think there's a certain point, though, where that becomes kind of delightful. Like, I think that if somebody is really aware of what they're doing, they're self-aware and they're doing it on purpose and there's sort of a humor to it, that sort of thing can be fun. Although I imagine at home that would breed contempt, would go to hate, and she would just hit him over the head with a pickle jar and that'd be it.
Yeah. That he's like, yeah, are you going to clean the toilet or not? I asked a simple question, and if you're not, I'll just do it. Why are you waving the toilet brush and talking about contempt? Right. I don't know where we are right now. But I just, in her case, I really can't embrace the idea that it would be like hilarious if she were like this.
Mm-hmm.
at home.
No. No, because I think she believes it,
falsely accusing the dog of pooping in the house, and it's like, oh, boy.
And if the dog does poop in the house, pure evil. Just pure evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing that's funny about this, too, is that after I watched it, I was like, okay, so I wanted to kind of look up a little bit, because she had this whole run, you know, like at the end about pure evil, and he did this, and everybody knew, and blah, 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 you know, and they all let him do it, and they're all responsible, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
And so I looked it up, and I was like, okay, so how long was it? This kid was arrested 5 days after the murder. So all of this about we're suspecting Daniel Horowitz is going to get arrested, there's all of this stuff, the police are absolutely zeroing. 5 days.
Yeah.
Which for, you know, like a standard, you know, murder investigation, that is whip quick. Like that is just the fastest turnaround, you know? And they found this kid, and they had had like, you know, we had the guy who was interviewing this kid, you know, who was like, you know, I had to let him go because so they'd figured it out. They'd called him in for the polygraph. He got let go by that guy. All of that happened before those 5 days were up. So how long was Horowitz actually under suspicion? 35, maybe 40 minutes. I don't know. But the way that she plays that whole thing up. And then it is the first time in the history of ever that I have ever seen Nancy Grace deploy what I would like to call the benefit of the doubt for even a minute. You know, and of course, that's because he's a friend of hers, you know?
Yeah. Well, right. And the other thing is, like, she is so sort of relentlessly like, well, they arrested this girl, and you know, she'll just be posting pictures. Like, there's she's like the go-to clip in prestige documentaries for someone who's getting unfairly judged based on a random face that this person made for a split second in court. Last week when we were talking about it, it was Michelle Carter of the texting case. And like I think I said then, like, there's no better way to get me on your client's side than to show Nancy Grace taking out after her. But what was interesting to me also is that because it's Nancy Grace, like, the show is obliged to not fluff, but like they sort of the injustice allegedly is, like you said, that her friend was under suspicion for perhaps one half an hour.
Maybe, yes.
But they also have to make it clear that law enforcement didn't suffer from tunnel vision, continued to investigate other avenues and work other theories of the case, and then successfully brought this kid to justice. So, of course, she's trying to have it both ways. And but here was one interesting bit. Also, from our next clip, Nancy Grace loves to pounce on people behaving inappropriately after the death of a loved one as basically circumstantial plus evidence. And this this clip, which is partly Horowitz talking about how he's feeling and why he's going to the media to help him find who killed his wife, is like, this is normally the kind of thing that she would be all over in terms of his phrasing. And then at the end of the clip, she has to come in and be like, I just wanted him to shut up. Like, well, yeah, like, all right, let me play the clip and then we'll talk more about it.
Officers and detectives involved in this case, once they saw that Dan had gone to the media and was sharing his version and his story, they thought it was quite odd, and he was trying to distract from him as being the responsible person, when in fact he was.
I am in sad mode, I'm in hurt mode, and I'm in mode that I am a professional, and I'm going to do what I think I need to do to catch the person who killed my wife. I'm going to do the media the way I think, and if people don't like how I do that or anything else, I don't give a damn.
All I can think about is, man, you're digging your own grave. Just stop talking.
I should sneak into my husband Dan's phone and make that his ringtone for when I'm calling.
Oh, you totally should.
except talk about contempt turning to hate and then turning to murder. ain't a court in the land would convict him. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was so interesting that he's like, I mean, if someone close to you is killed and you are thinking you're under suspicion, mm-hmm. are you like, I'm in sad mode? That's such a strange way to it's such a strange way to put it. And yeah. it's ordinarily the kind of thing that she'd be like, who says that? And there she kind of is like, oh, that doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. Well, I mean, but this is the thing, though. Like, people talk about how people should be responding to trauma. And right. the thing is that the way that people respond to trauma is almost never the way that you would expect, because the actual experience, I mean, this guy found his wife bludgeoned. I mean, we heard the 911 call. He was screaming. He was obviously like overcome. Who wouldn't be? I mean, my God, what a horrible experience.
I mean, granted, I didn't really need the show to explain to me what eviscerated means, yeah. but they did. And it
was terrible.
She was.
It was terrible.
Brutal.
Yeah. So going through stuff like that, like when you go through a traumatic event, the way that you respond to it, it's like all of everything compartmentalizes, right? So there's parts of you that can make everything look like you're just fine. Inside, it's all, you know, it's all turning and churning and just terrible. So like the idea that how somebody appears on the outside really is any indication of what's actually happening inside is completely false. And any psychologist, any 5 minutes with a psychologist, you'll know that. There's no way that Nancy Grace doesn't know that. But she takes this very surface read, you know, of these people and how they're behaving and says, well, that's not the way uh-huh. that an actual victim behaves or whatever. And makes those kinds of judgments because that's her shtick. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what keeps the money rolling in, you know, is kind of creating this very surface level read on these very complex and complicated situations, you know. But the way that he was behaving, like he's a defense attorney. He defends people who are under suspicion all the time. He knows how to use the media. So this guy, I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. Like this guy went through this highly traumatic experience. I mean, how awful. Wouldn't wish that on anyone, right? And then turns around and goes into like his defense lawyer compartment mode. That makes perfect sense to me. Everything
makes
he was
absolute
doing.
Sense.
Exactly.
That he's like, and attorneys also are able to marshal huge amounts of information quickly and just be able to like boil it down. And it's like, if this is your job and your kind of safe place emotionally, of course
that's what you go to. Absolutely.
What you do. Mm-hmm. I kind of wonder how much time she has left in a world where versus like 5 years ago, we know so much more about not just that there is no one way to process trauma or no correct way to process trauma. And that we know so much more about false confessions and how they're elicited and so much more about internalized judgments of the way that particularly women either accused or in situations like this, like the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, that we're judged so much more harshly.
Yes.
No matter how we decide to be. I wonder how much longer she has in a more aware media landscape.
She's going to be fine because her audience probably. Is not like young woke people. Like her audience is old people who are afraid of the kid who skateboard, you know, past their lawn every day. Like this is, she is very specifically speaking to a demographic that absolutely, you know, loves this stuff because the world, I mean, if you think about it, in the last, I don't know, 100 years, we've had more change in the world than in like probably all of human civilization before that, you know? So people like, especially people who are a little older now, and I mean, I'm kind of getting to be one of those people now, but people who are a little bit older are really, really freaked out by that. And so they want simplicity. They want somebody to come in and be like, it is this, it is that, it is black, it is white. Let me just simple this all down for you. Let me erase any nuance. Let me just completely tell you that this person is guilty and evil, you know, and so that is it and that is all. I think that there is a real, you know, like section of the country that really, really wants that and craves that simplicity. And to people who are, I think, a little more aware, a little more, have a little more media literacy, which people are kind of growing up with a little bit more now, things are much more complex. And we're able to kind of like, you know, look at a situation and kind of see all of that complexity. She exists for the people who either cannot see that complexity or have no interest in seeing that complexity.
Yeah,
and
or
I think she'll
actively resisting
exactly
complexity.
I think
because
she'll
it's
always
too
have an audience. I think she will grow old and die before that audience is gone.
Yeah, you're probably right. Our last clip, and then we can move on mm-hmm. from this, because honestly, it's absolutely nothing, yeah. listener, that you don't expect
yes.
from this program.
There are no surprises
more,
here.
More for everyone else, I think. But another thing that we know a lot more about now is juvenile development, mm-hmm. Emotional development, literal neurological development. I do not watch any Nancy Grace outside of this.
Yeah.
Spoiler. So, so I suspect, without being able to say for sure, that the idea that juvenile, like life sentences, death row sentencing, and that we have progressed somewhat in our thinking about how we are trying to punish and or rehabilitate juvenile offenders, mm-hmm. I don't think that her thinking has progressed about this at all. And I would not be surprised mm-hmm. if she and Horowitz were sitting around having a scotch and she was like, you know, what would be neat is if I could give you a soapbox for future parole hearings for Scott Dolezky,
yeah.
the convicted murderer who did this to his wife, that in case you can't attend, you could just remind people that yeah. he is a hopeless case who should be fired into the sun. Mm-hmm. So here's clip four.
One reason I'm willing to go on camera with this is that when I'm gone, I hope at his parole hearing, people can see me and hear me. And not just read my words or just read the cold words of a judicial opinion. I want you to see me and hear me. I'm saying this, Scott Dolezky is not an innocent juvenile whose brain was immature. He was a cold-blooded, vicious torturer who reveled in what he did and to this day has not changed at all.
I mean, look, let me be clear. Dolezky is not innocent.
Yeah.
And I don't expect Horowitz, of all people, to be like, well, let's think about a more like lenient or merciful approach mm-hmm. to the rehabilitation of this individual who literally gutted
yeah.
my wife. Like, no, mm-hmm. that is how you feel. And I completely get it. And that's fine. I just thought that it was very telling that the first episode is about a friend of Nancy Grace's mm-hmm. is somewhat hypocritical at times. And then it manages to tick every box of like, you know, what we have learned mm-hmm. or have sort of agreed to all understand about the way criminal quote justice quote functions. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, nope, black over here, white over here, mm-hmm. nothing in the middle.
Yeah. And I mean, it's tough because like I have nothing but sympathy for Daniel Hoare. I mean, I cannot even
sure.
imagine what that must be like or how I would feel, you know, in that circumstance. At the same time, the ways in which, I mean, this, you know, there was a whole, I don't know, like a 5-minute run. Nancy Grace didn't take a breath talking about, you know, his mother
yeah.
knew, his girlfriend knew, his art teacher knew, this so-called clean cut kid is pure evil and all these people let happen. So she's not just indicting this kid. She's indicting all of the people who loved that kid. And I have sympathy for them too. I mean, his mother What?
Oh yeah, she had some line who was like, "You raised this."
Yes.
Like, I don't think she's super psyched about it. Like,
well, yeah, but I mean, like, it's your kid. Like, you know, like, I mean, kids are goth. Kids go through. I knew a ton of kids in high school who did that kind of nonsense, and it was all affectation. Like, you don't know until the thing happens. The kid hadn't done anything else violent. He just, I mean, it's tragic. It's awful. What he did to this woman is terrible. At the same time, holding a space for compassion for the people who love this kid, holding a space of compassion for people who saw these things in him and thought it was just affectation, which, by the way, happens a lot, you know?
And you will see in our visual aids that Splatter presents across social media, there was a picture of him that they sort of, first of all, they put that newspaper pixelation effect on it to make him look even
more evil,
more evil, but it only had the effect of making it look like, it was almost campy.
Yeah.
How greasy and black his hair was and how much of it was in his face and the look that he's giving at the camera. Like, I wouldn't look at that kid and be like, he's going to do anything.
Yeah.
Because he's working too hard on his hair.
Right.
I mean, again, not to make light of it. And Horowitz feels how he feels. And I absolutely do not blame him. But we don't hear, I mean, of course, we don't hear from Scott Jalewski because this is a Nancy Grace program. And it's possible that he's still going around being a Satanist and,
like, well, being a Satan, I mean, like, you know, a lot of that stuff, the goth thing, a lot of that stuff is affectation. A lot of that stuff is bluster. And I don't think that it's, you know, reasonable for the expectation to be that, like, you know, everybody who comes across a kid like that, that art teacher, I guarantee you, whatever he did in her art class was, that is not her first rodeo. She'd seen that before. Like, kids do that stuff. Kids try on all of these personas to try to figure out who they are. That's natural. And even though, like, he's clearly guilty, there's tons of DNA evidence, there isn't, you know, there isn't space for, like, the question of whether or not he did this thing. He did this thing. You know, and it was terrible and awful and brutal and inhuman. But at the same time, like, I think that the idea of redemption being a possibility, the idea that somebody could come back from something like that, be a better person, and then be able to reach other people who are, who can understand, this person could understand that. Like, somebody who can have that redemption, who can come back from something like that and then be a help to other people who might be perpetrators, like, that can be a real value to society. And the thing is that, like, that's the whole point. The kid was 16. Like, yeah, he did something incredibly terrible, but it is entirely possible that he could come from that experience and end up being of value to other people. And the idea of throwing away anybody, of denying anybody an opportunity at redemption, to me personally, and again, I would, if I was Horowitz, I probably would not feel this way. But, you know, I think that denying anybody redemption is something that sort of denies our own humanity to ourselves, you know? And so that's something that, like, I personally feel is a big problem with the way that we view humans as disposable at a certain point, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah,
I have a whole long thing about that that really doesn't have anything to do with this, but...
But I think it does, because I think that Nancy Grace's whole brand, and why, as you said, and I wish I didn't agree, but I do, why she will continue to have success is that othering people in whatever situation, like, as long as they're not cops or, you know, DAs, like, her ability to... classify people as good and evil and us and them.
Yeah.
This is, you know, this is Trump's America, and that has its appeal. And whether or not we approve of it, that, you know, it does something for some people.
Yeah.
And she's not... A lot of like true crime programming that's like in the more traditional, like, trashy lane of the genre does this.
Yeah.
because it knows what it's for,
right?
And it knows why some people consume it. Mm-hmm. But that just made me pretty sad for everyone involved. Not to mention, who knows what, like, who knows why Dulesky was acting out in these ways or what trauma he might have been reacting against or trying to get attention for. I mean, we don't know, and certainly Nancy Grace is not in the business of
of making that argument. Yeah.
Nuance. She'd be like, nuance. Hell no.
Hell no. Yeah.
My imitation of her is getting too good, and we should probably move on. Do you have any final thoughts before we leave this one at the curb?
You know what? I'm ready to leave it. I think I'm ready to drop Nancy and just kind of leave her there, because it's,
All right.
There's not much going on there.
Mm-hmm. Someone will come get her.
Someone will come get her.
All right. Most Wanted, Section 2. Who Killed Garrett Phillips? This does not air, actually, until the 23rd of July on HBO. It's another two-part documentary directed by the great Liz Garbus. Here's the case file from HBO's landing page. I don't think this gives away any spoilers, but generally speaking, I think we will be getting into some of the information that is imparted by the documentary as to how this case was disposed. So the too long, didn't listen because of spoilers version is, this is an excellent sit. It's infuriating, but very well built. And the reason I know that is that I resisted Googling to see what happened, because the creation of tension and suspense was very effective. So if you don't really want to know anything and you want to go into it completely cold, skip ahead to the end of this podcast. Here's the case file from HBO's landing page. On October 24th, 2011, 12-year-old Garrett Phillips was murdered in his home in Potsdam, a small town in upstate New York. Police quickly zeroed in on a suspect in this unthinkable crime, Oral Nick Hillary, a black man in the mostly white community who was a soccer coach at Clarkson University and the ex-boyfriend of Garrett's mother, Tandy Cyrus. From two-time Academy Award nominee and Emmy winner Liz Garbus, who also directed HBO's A Dangerous Son and Nothing Left Unsaid, Gloria Vanderbilt, and Anderson Cooper, among others. And A Dangerous Son is on HBO Go, and I highly recommend it. It's very good. This absorbing two-part documentary looks at the case from the initial investigation through the arrest and numerous legal twists and turns that culminated in Hillary's trial for murder 5 years after the crime. The two-part documentary raises troubling questions of racial bias and issues surrounding policing and the criminal justice system. This one was so much better that I almost feel like putting the two properties in the same genre is insulting to, like, the word genre.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of this one overall?
Oh, I thought it was really good. I thought it was really well built. It was nicely put together. It's a documentary style. Nancy Grace is this kind of almost the shock jock of true crime, you know?
Yes.
And this is an actual documentary, kind of going in and taking a look at everything that was going on at the time. And the thing is that, you know, myself, like, being fairly familiar with, like, the story of Curtis Flowers, the Adnan Syed, you know, and it feels to me like here we are, lather, rinse, repeat, with another circumstance where we have a person of color who the police have just decided is guilty, and there you go. And so even though the documentary, I think, really tries to present this, you know, like, fully putting all of the information out there and feeling like it felt to me like it was unbiased in its presentation of the material. But you can be unbiased when it's so clear, you know, that this is a railroad. And I'm not saying that, like, this guy didn't necessarily do it. I mean, I can't know that. All I can say is that there's no evidence at all, really, linking this guy to this murder. And so the way that they present it, even with an unbiased presentation, you know, an objective presentation, it seemed really, really clear to me that this is just the classic railroading, you know, of a person of color. I don't know. Did you see that?
Well, first of all, I'm on the record as feeling that trying to be too unbiased or trying too hard to be unbiased and objective as a documentary filmmaker, you end up with this kind of airless product. Mm-hmm. It's like Patty says to Graham in My So-Called Life, like, grow up, pick a side. especially with this stuff, like, I think that some outrage is earned, warranted and earned, if you are a filmmaker with, you know, either some standing, as Liz Garbus is, or you've done the work to lay out the situation and you've been very careful about the chronology, and the audience can trust that while you do have an opinion, you've laid out all the information so that we're allowed to have a different opinion and you're not pushing too hard on your own. But I, what I thought this documentary did well, particularly the like adherence to a chronological telling of this story, where it would have been very tempting to sort of drop little, not Easter eggs in, but hints or sort of flat or, you know, begin at the end, which they did, but not exactly. And that sort of felt like a little nod to OJ Made in America, the way that you sort of start out in a different courtroom. Anyway, I thought that was very well done. And I thought she also did a good job leaving the question open as to whether this was deliberate railroading or just not even incompetence, but just short-sightedness, inexperience, blundering. Certainly once you get to the district attorney's office, it does seem like both. Why not both? Little of column A, little of column B. But the what really struck me also is that this documentary is called Who Killed Garrett Phillips, and law enforcement does not seem interested in actually finding that out, and we're no closer to knowing at the end than we are at the beginning. The first clip is from a reporter. I believe this guy is the Albany bureau chief at the New York Times, and he's talking about the fact that the cops are under pressure to come up with someone, so they picked the wrong someone. Here's clip five.
Okay, we've got a dead 12-year-old, and the first 48 hours of this are critical, and we have a killer on the run, and we have to find out who did this. So you can understand the police's viewpoint. And yet, you do also have to raise questions as to why they chose Nick Hillary, why he was the guy, what sort of evidence they were working with, what sort of tips they were working with. Were they following other tips? Were there other suspects? Were there other people that, as they were focusing so heavily on Nick, they could have gotten away?
Yeah. And meanwhile, like, everyone and their mom is calling into Potsdam Dispatch to be like, oh, hey, did you hear about John Jones's girlfriend's kit? Like, oh, my God, North Country. I don't want to be that guy. Pull it together. I mean, sorry, Potsdam, but
well, it seems it's a small town.
You're crazy for this one.
It's clearly a small town. And everybody,
had you heard of this case? I mean, not that you live that much closer to it than I do.
I'm not that far from it, actually. And the guy from Onondaga County, the DA from Onondaga County, who came up to be part of the trial, is actually my DA, because that's where I live, in Onondaga County. Never vote for him, but it just keeps happening. He just keeps being my DA anyway. So I don't know. Did we vote for the DA? I think we do. I think we do.
No, you do, because there's a whole
thing about them running for
this
DA,
where they're like, you need to pay attention, because that's who that's
it's
who's
huge.
Ruining lives.
These
is
are the people
DA.
That are ruining lives. These are So it's interesting because that guy being involved in this because he was the head of some committee or whatever seemed a little bit weird to me. And I was also like, well, we don't got enough murders in Syracuse. You got to go up to Potsdam and be part of this whole thing. So that was a little bit weird. I don't like that guy. It's not fun seeing him. But overall, I mean, I think that you know, we have this thing, like the New York Times bureau chief guy was talking about, that while there's a lot of pressure when there's a murder like this, especially a high profile murder like this, especially the murder of a kid, you know, something like that's so terrible, you know, that when there's something like that, there is a lot of pressure to find somebody, to like have somebody. And part of it, I'm not sure, like I'm not sure what it is. Is it incompetence? Is it that they look at it and they say, well, it's likely this guy, and we've got all white community. Here we have a person of color, probably going to get the, you know, the conviction from a jury in this town, right? You know, I mean, I hate to add that kind of cynicism into, you know, like accuse the police of that kind of cynicism, but with some of the cases that we've been seeing, with the things that happen, with the decision that it is this person, and so rather than looking at the evidence and having it lead you somewhere, they try to fashion the evidence around the person that they want it to be. And I'm not sure. I'm sure it's very complicated, you know, the motivations and what's going on. And I know that there are, you know, good people working, you know, some of my best friends are cops, that kind of thing. You know, that there are people who are working really hard to try to make sure that they can bring justice to a grieving family. But at the same time, like, all of this seemed so ridiculous when they were talking about, they had the video of them like interviewing Nick Hillary that first day, you know, and it was so bumbling. And like, I don't, the true crime is not my thing. I do this because I love you, right? As I don't watch this all the time. I'm not a Law and Order person. I don't like any of that. And even me watching it, I'm like, oh, this can't be legal. This can't be good. Like, there's nothing. They just seemed like Keystone Cops. They were so, like,
and
clearly
incompetent. And this is one of the cases where the suspect is like, nope.
Yeah.
Like, he's calling an attorney and they're like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm calling an attorney. I've watched TV. I know what you're trying to do.
I'm a person of color in America. I know what's happening.
Yeah.
Here, right? Yes.
And then he's also like, well, I'm free to leave, right? Uh-huh. And they're like, well, you don't want to do that. And he's like, uh-huh, says you. I'm free to leave. And then he's like the one man in the history of cases like this who actually is like, fuck out of here,
yeah,
and leaves.
Yeah.
And it, like, it still doesn't work out for him.
Right. Yeah.
But, yeah, I wonder how much of it too is that, I mean, not to be that, you know, famous New Yorker cartoon where it's like New York and then the rest of the country,
right,
and the rest of the world. But like, I think that if you are in a smaller community where either there's just like fewer people,
yeah,
and there's fewer crimes, mm-hmm, and a lot of it is like, it's just opioid stuff, and
mm-hmm,
maybe there's a murder a year, mm-hmm, that you actually saw this with JonBenet.
Yeah.
It was a kid. It was extremely high profile. Boulder was a relatively safe place. Mm-hmm. They had absolutely no idea the powder keg that,
yeah,
had just been lit. And they're like, you know, this is what we're focusing on is the parents, because odds tell us it's that, and we have to have something to tell the press.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's not inexperience necessarily, but maybe that.
Well, unprepared. You're unprepared for it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, how
Which
can you
is,
be?
It, that's nice,
yeah,
that you are living in a place like that and, mm-hmm, doing your jobs that way, but when the time comes,
mm-hmm,
there's also what North Country Public Radio reporter Natasha Haverty pointed out, which is that you're in a part of the state where, like, Attica, like, that's,
mm-hmm,
that's not a joke. Like, I used to drive through there all the time going to Toronto, and it's like prisons,
mm-hmm,
the Holiday Inn for prison visitors,
yes,
a restaurant,
mm-hmm,
is the town. So that's something that affects people's perceptions of people who are different from them. Whatever. She puts it a lot better than I can. So here's clip six.
We talk about the North Country being really white and remote, but also that that Potsdam is situated in New York's prison country. It's a community in an area that kind of like its lifeblood is corrections. And we think about racial dynamics, how a lot of white people's only interactions with black people are when they're in a uniform as a corrections officer guarding inmates of color. It's just something to keep in mind.
And, you know, sort of secondarily, that this and meth mm-hmm. are the industries.
Mm-hmm.
No, excuse me. This, meth, and one of the four universities.
Yes.
That's in the area. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, weird options
yeah.
for a kid growing up locally.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was a really good point, that you have this kind of almost unconscious understanding of the world mm-hmm. in that on that particular us and them axis.
Yeah.
I had a couple of, not quibbles with this documentary, but I just had things that I was like writing down as questions that I still had.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the police did not investigate some of these theories, we don't necessarily hear much about them
mm-hmm.
after that. And because at a certain point, the mom, she has like one talking head snippet.
Yeah.
In the beginning, and then she becomes more of a, like, she's not interacting with the filmmakers
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, like, it seems that this team was embedded with this case for almost a decade.
Yeah.
So I am extremely impressed by that, by the access they got to almost everyone who was involved on both sides of the aisle, including people who have to have known that they were starting to look like real shitwits and continue talking
yeah.
to the filmmakers, including Tandy's other ex-boyfriend, John Jones. Like, we don't hear a ton more about Garrett's alleged conflicts with Nick Hillary mm-hmm. about, like, horsing around, I think, was probably the issue. And that Garrett just didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear much about what Garrett thought about John Jones, but we do hear a fair bit about other people theorizing that John Jones might have been involved. John Jones inserts himself into the investigation, like, day two.
Mm-hmm.
John Jones has absolutely no upper lip at all, and it makes him look untrustworthy. That's my thing. Sorry, people with slender upper lips.
I hadn't really thought about that as a theory. But he is a creeper guy. The first time they talk to him, like, the first time we see him before any of the, like, weirdness, there's this moment where they're interviewing him and he mentions her, and you see the smile come over his face. Like,
yeah.
And I was like, dude is still in love with this woman, you know? And mm-hmm. I don't know, as we move through, I was like, oh, let me revise. Dude is obsessed with this woman. There are so many little things throughout this. And as we moved forward with this whole thing, there was this point where he was talking about how he helped her when she had to move out with Hillary, helped her find an apartment. And then said something like, you know, it was close to me, but that's not why I did it. It was about convenience for the boys, you know? And I was like, dude, like, this is so clear, and it's weird, and it's creepy, and I am not at all convinced that he's not involved in this.
No, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch to make the math work, but yeah. That didn't stop law enforcement with Nick Hillary.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. I have a whole rant about that later, but he just inserts himself into this investigation and goes with her to the police interview
yeah.
and is calling dispatch and kind of wondering who was sent to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's not appropriate. And then come to find out later that she had gotten a restraining order.
Yeah.
against, and she, and then when he's talking about that, he's like, oh, well, she didn't write that up. She doesn't know those big words. Like,
right. Which, first of all, so insulting.
You don't just like go on LegalZoom and write your own restraining order. That's not how that works. It was written for her, Jackwagon. I actually do watch a lot of these shows. Mm-hmm. Go fuck yourself. I know what's going on here. Right. Second of all, fuck you.
Yes.
And third of all, this guy, I think there's a whole like sort of tone poem docudrama to be made about just her life.
Yeah.
That she is this very beautiful bartender, mm-hmm. In a small town, who's the father of Garrett's father, I'm not sure about the other son,
yeah.
died of an aneurysm mm-hmm. when Garrett was like three.
Yeah.
And like, oh my God, the grandparents going to have coffee mm-hmm. in the cemetery
yeah.
was so sweet and sad. Mm-hmm. And you don't blame them for seizing on any answer to people keep being taken from them anyway. Mm-hmm. And you know, John Jones is like that, you know, big shot cop in a small town mm-hmm. who got the hot foxy bartender and then is pissed that other people are looking at her. And when they broke up, he put her shit out on the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and also,
and was harassing her. And it's like, okay.
Well, and said, like, he has this whole thing, you know, where, like, he clearly states that she was cheating on him with Nick Hillary, which adds a level of complication to this, on top of which she had put a restraining order against him. But then when this happens, he's there, he's holding her hand. He's in the interrogation room with her. Like, that's weird.
It's not appropriate.
No.
And I'm not convinced that she was cheating on him. I think she broke up with him and then he was being weird and stalky and was like,
yeah.
well, I'm just going to go see if I should start dating other people also. Like,
yeah.
oh, okay. You can do that in a text.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's
anyway,
so weird.
You called for this clip and this should give listeners a pretty good idea of what a creep wagon John Jones is. Here's clip 7.
When Tandy and I started having real difficulties towards the end, I was trying to figure out, you know, what's going on, what's happening, and Nick's name was brought up a couple times, and I just happened to be at the right place, I guess, at the right time to see the two of them drive by one early morning. Mm-hmm. And so I felt the need to find out for myself if they were dating each other, that I can move on in my life and start dating myself. And so I confronted Nick at his residence.
At his residence.
Mm-hmm.
Was the right place at the right time in a bush outside Tandy's building?
Yeah.
With a bottle of Astroglide and a police scanner because you're a pig. I'm a little sorry. I'm not that sorry.
No, that's fine. It's fine. Yeah, I got a creepy vibe from him from the beginning. And every time they showed him, something else he said, something else he did, something in the expression on his face when he talked about her, all of it made me think, you know, like, because I'm looking at this and I'm like, okay, so let's just say, like, Nick Hillary didn't get along with this 12-year-old, right? And that's why Tandy and her kids moved into an apartment, because the kids couldn't get along with Nick or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So the motivation to kill the kid for Nick, I'm not sure I make that connection. Like, he's going to kill the kid and then she's going to move back in with him. She's still got the other kid who doesn't like him, you know?
Yeah.
So that seems like a bit of a stretch. But, and again, not accusing, I don't know, no evidence, like, it's, but the cop that everybody knows that could be close to the investigation, that can comfort her when mm-hmm. something bad happens to her, I don't know, like, he seems a little obsessed with her.
This is something that would force her
mm-hmm.
back into his,
because he could be a value to
control.
Her not to mention
yeah.
this guy has a clear beef with Nick, so if he's setting that up. I don't know.
I mean, as to what actually happened, like, I am not clear. Maybe this was made clear and I just missed it, but I'm not totally clear on how Garrett felt about John Jones, but I don't think he was unaware of how his mother felt about it and the fact that a complaint was sworn out. I mean,
in which
I
she said that her kids were at danger, were in danger from this guy. She felt that her sons were in danger from this guy. And then she felt her sons were in danger from this guy. One of her sons gets killed. And in that day, they said at one point that he had spent the night at her house that night, you know?
Yeah.
Because he was a cop, maybe, you know, and she's clearly distraught. And this poor woman, like, you know, we're focusing on Nick Hillary, we're focusing on John Jones, you know. But one of the things, like, you know, we talked to her very briefly, and then she's just kind of like this personality that's present in like the news footage and everything, but not really.
Kind of been leveraged by Mary Rain, the then DA the prosecutor, to first win the election to become the DA, and then to continue bringing charges in two different grand juries, which, like, here's the ham sandwich they indicted. Unbelievable.
No.
And she's like on a mic, on camera, like, well, we think he did it, so we won't be continuing to investigate. Like, cool.
Yeah.
Way to take this seriously. Former public defender. Oh, God, she's the worst.
Yes. She's awful.
she's so bad. But again, like, Tandy sort of, and she may have like subtracted herself. From the narrative, because after a while, the only family member we really hear from is Garrett's uncle, Brian. Which, you know, that's fine. And people might get sick of talking to a documentary crew or feel like maybe they're getting the sense that
their sympathy lies.
Yeah, the Nick did it narrative is perhaps not going to hold up for the crew anyway. But, you know, they show her in court. I do think that the documentary is respectful of her impossible position in this story, which is like her loved ones and like control over her life and who she gets to love and for how long just keeps being taken from her. And if she chose to go with this narrative that made any little sliver of it make even a little bit of sense, the film is kind of like, well, she's just trying to get from one end of the day to the other, and it doesn't judge her, which is not easy, because it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating to watch from the vantage point of feeling that Nick is being railroaded. But you can absolutely see emotionally how she's like, you know, whatever, sure. Maybe closure is real. I will just go with this version. And when he is acquitted, found not guilty, she's destroyed. Garrett's uncle Brian is destroyed. And it's like, God, these poor people, like, I don't see how they can think this is really what happened. But if something that makes sense for them, like,
you know, the cops are saying, we're sure it's him. You've got this Jones creeper who has inserted himself into this whole thing saying, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's him. And it is fairly easy, especially, you know, in heightened emotional circumstances like that, to have somebody give you an answer and you just say, okay, because it's not like, how can a mother, how can she look at any of this with any, how can she look at it with any objectivity? You know, I mean, she's got to be devastated. I can't even imagine what this poor woman has been through. Not to mention having all of this, there are news crews, there are people who are, you know, who are, I'm sure there were people who were judging her. You know, I'm absolutely certain that this woman was slut shamed. This documentary doesn't do it, but I don't doubt for a minute
it's
happened.
Alluded to for sure.
Yeah.
And John Jones kind of does it in addition to implying that she's stupid.
Right. God. He is the worst.
He's a treat.
But he's, you know, but I'm sure that he's filling all of their heads with, you know, this was Nick, you know, that he did this. When people tell you that, I cannot even begin to imagine what that must have been like for the family. I don't blame them at all, because it is not their job to investigate. It is not their job to be objective. It is not their job to figure out who did it. You know, it is the only thing that they want is closure, and they want justice. And the thing is that the cops, when they zero in on, we're going to mold the evidence around this guy because we've decided that he did it, they're doing a disservice, clearly, to the person who's wrongly accused, but they're doing a disservice to that family too, because that's not closure.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's, I'm thinking of Making a Murderer, which I thought was very well done, but there was a certain aspect to that property's treatment of the Hallback family.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, it didn't sink to the level of like contemptuous or anything, but there was the sense that the filmmakers were a little bit baffled or not as able to feel compassion for the determination of this family to have any answer.
You've and just that, gotta want it over. How can you possibly blame anybody?
Yeah, because
who's been
it's like
that.
It doesn't. This is like the only cold comfort that you get in the situation, and when that's denied you too, of course you're upset, because it's like, now, you know, now the story has an even worse ending. So I do think that this it's a sort of weird thing to like plug the documentary for, but now that we're talking about it, it is a relatively rare feat to stay up on that tightrope of, we don't think this was the right guy, but we have enormous compassion for the family wanting that to be the guy. And that's not something that you necessarily see at all in projects of this type. So I think that's really something. Now I'd like to play a couple of clips shitting on local law enforcement, because I like a pile-on. And I'd just like to point out that when John Jones basically calls his obsessee too dumb to know big words, I'd just like to point out that other members of law enforcement are perhaps not the absolute sharpest awls in the tool belt. You asked for a clip concerning the fact that they did this completely unorthodox and uncalled for strip search of Nick Hillary. I'm not sure we pulled the same. I'm not sure we're thinking of the same exact sequence. Let me play clip 8 and then we can discuss how insane this is.
Yeah.
I don't normally do strip search. This was New York State FIU, who normally do searches of people's persons, and this was normal procedure. Trying to document injuries pursuant to the murder of a 12-year-old boy. There were other people that were photographed nude as well, and I pointed that out in the deposition. But
who else was photographed
nude? Garrett Phillips was.
Yeah, part of my what the fuck on that.
I've now heard that sequence like 3 times.
Yeah.
I'm still speechless. Like, Garrett Phillips was being autopsied.
Yeah.
You idiot.
Not a suspect in his own murder, dude. Like,
no.
Yeah. And that whole thing, the whole scripture, the thing, the part that I called out to was when Hillary's lawyer friend from New York City, who was, you know, up here and being a support to him, when he said, you don't do a strip search. Like, the only reason to do that is to break him down mentally, you know?
Yeah.
And that's absolutely, like, it was so degrading. And we saw the video of them taking each piece of his clothing, you know? sending him back home in a hazmat suit, you know?
Oh, God. And on top of that, while he is explaining that, you know, well, we were going to look for injuries.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's not what pursuant to means, Mark. whatever, vehicle, residence. Mm-hmm. But then there's nothing.
Yeah.
Not even the normal, like, dings of life.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't have a mosquito bite. He hadn't nicked himself shaving.
He had, like, a scrape on his ankle.
He had, like, that one scrape.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know. I banged it on some furniture. They're like, what furniture? He's like, I don't fucking know.
And then when they're talking about it,
they're like... The not killing Garrett Phillips divan? Fuck off.
No, but then they're all like, well, if I got... you know, injured moving furniture, I would know which piece of furniture it was. And I'm like, okay, I've moved furniture before where you're so busy, you're doing the stuff. And then like the next day you're like, oh God, look what I did to my elbow or whatever. Like you discover it the next day and you're like, I guess it happened moving the piano or whatever. So, yeah, like all of that, the way that the cops were, it didn't matter what Nick Hillary said or did or anything. They were molding it to the narrative that they had already decided
Absolutely.
Was the case.
Yeah.
And to do that strip search, it's so dehumanizing. And when his lawyer was talking about it, I was like, yeah, absolutely. They did that just to break him down. And they were, and then at that point in the interrogation when they were like, look, we get it. You didn't mean to kill the kid, you know? And they're jumping ahead to this whole thing, trying to like, I don't know, trick him into some kind of confession.
And he's like, yeah, I see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a stupid man. The whole thing was so uncomfortable. And then like when like in that clip you just played, when the police are talking, they are taking the shovel and just digging their grave. Like everything they say is clearly, you know, they're clearly molding what evidence they got to a narrative that they had already pre-decided. And it's so incredibly clear throughout this whole thing and everything that they do and everything that they say. And then there was the one guy who was like, yeah, well, you know, looking back, it was really inappropriate to have Jones there. You know, I wouldn't do that again. And I'm like, but you got to do it once. You had one bite at that apple and you screwed it up, dude. You know,
you also have to wonder, like, I suspect that whatever happened, it was an accident.
Yeah.
And then people waited for those witnesses to be done changing the tire. Mm-hmm. And then whoever it was, because they mentioned that he'd been having, quote, trouble at school.
There were bullies.
They don't really elaborate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He could have been just failing biology. Who knows?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it could have been other kids playing that knockout game they're talking about, which we did dumb shit like that when I was 12.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like 12-year-olds don't change, just the world. Mm-hmm. But it could have been John Jones, who like Garrett maybe lipped off to him. He backhanded him. He hit his head.
Yeah.
Who knows?
It could be anything.
I suspect that John Jones suggested like this is a possible avenue of getting him to admit that it was something that went terribly wrong because that's what happened to John Jones.
Yeah.
So, there's also among Mary Rain's numerous other flaws, and I believe she has been removed from
the
bar.
DA's office. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for repeated prosecutorial misconduct. Like, well, finally, there's some problems with her math.
Mm-hmm.
not a student of track and field, young Mary. Here's our final clip.
So you have a very tight timeline of 4:53 when we last see Hillary on the high school video to 5:06 when we believe the murder occurred. That would have given him enough time to go down two blocks, park the car, and you have to remember he's extremely fit. He's not only got a six pack, he's got an eight pack. He's very, very fit. And to jog two blocks to get to Garrett's home wouldn't take but 45 seconds max for him. We believe he had a key. We believe he opened the door. Garrett recognized that it was him, tried to push him back out, and then tried to retreat, and he was murdered.
Yeah, I'm sure that is what happened. I don't think it was Nick that did it. I'd also like to note, you know about his 8-pack because you made him do a fucking strip search.
Yeah.
That's A.
Mm-hmm.
B, listeners do not have the benefit of the visuals, but while she's talking about how him running 2 blocks in 45 seconds would be no problem, like, all right, he's a soccer coach.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But then on the map, it tells you that it's 0.4 miles.
Yeah.
That's almost half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
The current world record for the mile is 3 minutes, 43 seconds. Unless he had a jetpack. And on top of that, he's got to like drive to someplace, park the car, and then run.
Yeah.
No. And no one sees this guy running like 45 miles an hour?
Right. What? And not to mention, I'm sorry, but it is a rural upstate New York white community. A black man running through town. I'm sorry. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. A black man running through town is going to get some attention. It just is, you know?
Especially that black man who I think was already getting clocked by at least one member of the community for dating a white lady.
Yes. Yes. That's a whole other problematic issue in and of itself.
It's like he's the Flash.
Yeah.
The murderous Flash.
Yeah.
Running through, invisible
too, you know?
Yeah.
Try being a person of color in a white community and be invisible. Like it's not easy.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't think that's how that goes.
It's not. It's unfortunate, but it's not. So the reality of that situation is that all of this is so highly implausible. And again, like, you know, no DNA evidence, right? There's no actual evidence of any kind except that he took a left coming out of the high school instead of taking a right, you know? But even that, like, there's so much that has to happen in that short period of time. A deliberate murder, you know, if you're going in somewhere and your intent is to kill somebody, that can happen pretty quickly, right? But an accidental murder seems like it takes time to like work your way up to the incredible like confluence of events that accidentally kill somebody.
Actually, I know he's 12, but he's 12, not 2.
Yeah.
My understanding, never having murdered anyone, is that strangling someone is difficult and takes a while.
Yeah. Yeah. So
like it's not like a Vulcan neck pinch.
No,
so
it's not like you go and
their
shoot
timeline,
shoot him in the
which
head.
Is like, well, it's a very tight timeline that we have hammered this square peg into this round hole. She doesn't put it like that, but someone else does at some point.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's like when you're saying it out loud, do you hear yourself? I'm really asking.
Yeah.
Do you hear yourself?
I think it's just that Nancy Grace mentality. You know, it's just this, this is the guilty person and we are going to commit to that. And this person's going to be guilty. I think that there are a lot of pressures. There are a lot of things involved in the ways in which detectives and prosecutors are just pressured to produce something, you know, and
That they are having to tell the family.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I don't. That's an unenviable position, and I have compassion for that, too, up to a point that you don't want to turn to this grieving family and say, this isn't the guy, and we actually don't have any other leads, unless you ask your guardian angel over there to leave the room, and then maybe we have something to tell you.
Right.
But, I mean, but that's why I don't have that job, because I'm not sure I'd be able to do that either. So it's good that I'm not in the position.
Right.
And Mary Rain shouldn't have been, because she's, I think, not built for like keeping a course.
Yeah, but those are the people.
Set.
Those are the people who get elected because they present this simple. I mean, this is why, you know, Nancy Grace is popular, because if you present the actual reality in all of its nuance. First of all, there is no broadcast, like a typical feature for broadcast journalism. When I was working in broadcast journalism, like 20 years ago, was a minute 20. right? I don't even know what it is now.
It's probably, lucky to have verbs in there.
Right.
Totally.
Exactly. Like you can't get across nuance, you know, in that time. You can't tell a full story in that time. We had, you know, I don't know, what was this? 3 hours of 3+ hours of this. And it took that long. To get any of that nuance, you know, in this story.
And there's still stuff that I was like, well, what about X? What about Y?
Exactly. You can't get it all in. You just can't. It's impossible. So the idea of, and not to mention the fact that we don't as a culture encourage critical thought. We don't as a culture encourage comfort with uncertainty. We don't as a culture encourage the embracing of nuance, you know.
Shame.
Yeah.
Shame not a priority anymore, right. Apparently. And there is a certain shamelessness to her having this mom, Tandy, next to her at campaign events.
Yeah.
And having that be her issue.
Mm-hmm.
Singular.
Yeah. She picked that out.
I suspect. Yeah. And then she kind of let herself be pushed around by your district attorney,
yes.
And then she accidentally screwed him over by committing a Brady violation. And he was like, that was sort of an amazing moment that he's like, I wanted to leave, but I had to just sit there. I was like, sorry, bitch.
Yeah.
Like, you did this to yourself.
Yeah. No, he's the worst. He's the worst.
Yeah.
He deserves that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad they
found okay
the violation. But yeah, no, it's... It's heartbreaking. We've got real problems with our justice system. We've got real problems with the things that we do, you know. And I think that people like the cops are genuinely trying to solve this stuff. They are under a lot of pressure. And in a town where you don't have a lot of this stuff, you don't have the experience, you know, it's an impossible situation. It really is. But when it comes right down to it, no matter what, like, I am not a cop. I don't know what it's like to be in that position, but I do know that you have to have the evidence lead you. You don't lead the evidence, and you have to know that that's what you're doing. You know, you can't, I don't think you can do that accidentally, you know, to a certain degree.
Yeah,
I mean, they may truly, genuinely believe him to be guilty. They may have convinced themselves that he's guilty, so they're going to do this. And then once you go down that path, I mean, to have to look at yourself and recognize that you made a really poor choice that could ruin lives, like that cannot be easy. And I think most people would continue fooling themselves and convincing themselves that this guy was guilty, because once they're in for a penny, in for a life sentence, you know?
Well, and especially once a verdict has been rendered, it is, as we often hear in properties about this kind of case, where it's fairly clear that the wrong person is in prison, but it's just extremely difficult logistically to undo even
that.
If everyone involved agrees Literally that it
knows.
Should be done.
Yeah. It's all of it very, very complicated. And I don't want to come out here swinging like all of these prosecutors, like all of these cops and these detectives, these, you know, these justice systems are all bad actors doing bad things deliberately. I think that we have set up a system that fails spectacularly on a million different fronts because of competing incentives, you know, for solving these things, and a lack of understanding and appreciation for how difficult this is to do properly and correctly. And that means you have to do it carefully and you have to move super slowly. And that is not something that we encourage, because DAs who have to be elected have to have a Nancy Grace story that they can tell.
Just, you know, there's really a lack of, this is where the lack of nuance becomes actively harmful and unjust. I'm thinking mostly of sentencing, but
we've got a terribly, terribly broken justice system, and fixing that is a job for people who are way smarter than me, because I don't even know where you would start with that.
Yeah, I don't either. I think sort of prioritizing punishment and rushes to judgment over figuring out what actually happened, because let's not forget, the child died and we still don't know what happened. We have no idea.
And now it's been so long, we'll probably never know.
Yeah. I mean, they're pursuing it. Yeah. Chiron said at mm-hmm. the end,
yeah.
This isn't a pick me up. And I will also say there are a couple of upsetting images. They don't show anything too
yeah.
gruesome, but there is a shot of Garrett after the attempts of EMS to revive him mm-hmm. had failed. It was a lot. Yeah. It's emotional to watch, but Garbus, this is one of the most gently constructed, I guess, documentaries I've seen in quite some time, that, as we've been saying about all of the many issues and arguments in play here, that she lets both sides breathe
yeah.
and is not trying to, it's clear where she's coming from,
mm-hmm.
but nobody involved is judged. I think she has a lot of compassion for the difficulties mm-hmm. of everyone in the community
yeah.
in trying to contend with this tragedy, mm-hmm. with this untimely death that remains unsolved. I mean, I guess she could have been a little meaner to Mary Rain, but Mary Rain does a lot.
Mary Rain does
herself.
The job herself. Like, you don't
yeah,
need to be mean to Mary Rain.
Any help?
Just put
like
a microphone in front
asshole.
Of her, and she takes herself down. So yeah,
yeah mm-hmm. she sure does.
Yeah,
much like I do. That's the one. It's the one thread of commonality. It's important. It's important to find common ground. Also, our last names are both nouns.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
And that's it. I might cross the street to kick her in the shins. Thank you so much for watching both of these properties, both upsetting each in a different way. I appreciate it. I know this isn't your genre, but you say such smart things.
It's always fun. You know what, Sarah? Hanging out with you, I will watch anything if it means I get to talk to you for an hour or so. I don't care what it is.
Oh, girl. What have you done? Speaking of that, what are you up to right now? What are you doing that listeners can check out your other stuff?
Oh, my goodness. Tons of stuff. I over at chiprush.com, you can find a ton of podcasts that I'm doing. I'm doing Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'm doing Angel the Series. We got the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Just finished doing a run on Good Omens, the book and TV series by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. And on my YouTube channel, I am doing a new series called Nerd Chipper, where Ian Martin from Passion of the Nerd, who also does a lot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer analysis, he and I actually aren't talking about Buffy. We're just talking about life and things and the world and how it works and getting all philosophical in these little videos that we do every couple of weeks. So you can find all of my stuff. Just go to chiprush.com. You'll find everything referenced there.
And that will all be in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, and careful what you wish for.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to hang out with you, Sarah.
Aw, you're so sweet. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Toby Ball returns to talk about the McMartin trials on Uncovered, that's on Oxygen. Someone will be talking about No One Saw a Thing, possibly no one, who knows. Eve Beatty's back to discuss the free Meek Mill series on Amazon Prime, and Alex Segura returns to discuss Leah Carroll and Miami Crime. In the meantime, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents across all platforms, and at Eve's and my True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. If we get 2,000 paid subscribers, we will cover the Theranos trial. Let's get after it. My guest has been Lonnie Diane Rich, and she is on Twitter at Chipperish. I am Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.